From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with exiled white South African journalist Donald Woods. After being placed under house arrest for his anti-apartheid activism, he escaped South Africa by disguising himself as a priest. Also today, I talk with comic Jerry Seinfeld. Growing up in suburbia is one source of his material. He was born in Massapequa, which he says is Indian for by the mall. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the newest recording from 95-year-old pianist Mstislav Horzovsky. And guest commentator David Mark rises to defend television against those who blame it for the decline in literacy. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is Donald Woods, a white South African journalist now living in exile in England. As editor of the South African opposition paper, The Daily Dispatch, Woods was outspoken in his views against apartheid. It was through his work that he met Stephen Biko, the leader of the South African Students' Organization, an all-black group at the forefront of the black consciousness movement. 10 years ago, Biko died in prison from a beating at the hands of South African police. After Woods led the call for an investigation into Biko's death, he was placed under a 5-year banning order. Rather than submit to constant surveillance, he escaped from South Africa by sneaking across the border. Donald Woods now lives in London, where he continues his campaign against apartheid. A movie about his relationship with Stephen Biko will premiere in November. It's titled Cry Freedom, and it's directed by Sir Richard Attenborough, who also directed Gandhi. I spoke to Donald Woods during his recent visit to America, shortly after the publication of a collection of his newspaper columns titled South African Dispatches, which is published by Holt. I asked him to read the column that he called Two Men in a Bathroom.
This article explains the background or gives a practical example of how the pass laws operated in South Africa for blacks. See, all blacks had to carry a passbook. Some months ago, I arrived home to find a police van outside my house and some stalwarts in uniform about to enter the front door in pursuit of two blacks they believed to be unregistered. That means not having passes. They had challenged the two to produce their passes to prove they were allowed to be in a white area, and the two had run away. "We saw them run this way, and we think they're in your house," said the chief stalwart. I told them to watch the front door while I looked inside, and they appeared to appreciate such cooperation, perceiving it would make easier their task of preserving our own identity and protecting our traditional way of life. Inside the house, I ran upstairs to be told by my wife that she had hidden the two men in the guest room. After a hasty consultation, she took the two men into a bathroom with her and locked the door, knowing it would be beyond the parameters of a white South African policeman's mentality to conceive of a white woman being locked in a bathroom with two black men. Meanwhile, the men in uniform were admitted to begin their search, which was painstakingly thorough. They looked everywhere, under beds, in cupboards, behind curtains. I couldn't resist standing guiltily in front of one cupboard I knew to be completely empty, so naturally they wanted to look inside. "No need," I said, "no need." The cupboard was empty, and I stayed in front of it, moving my eyes furtively from side to side, in what I hoped was a guilty manner. They ordered me to step aside, wie hef weis, and it was a pleasant moment when they opened the door and went through the whole Mother Hubbard bit. I think it was that empty cupboard that broke them, because their search became increasingly listless thereafter. Finally, I indicated the bathroom door, and the chief stalwart seized the handle, just as my wife, with perfect timing, announced her occupancy. They backed away as if stung, apologizing to her through the locked door. After they left, the two fugitives emerged, falling about with laughter at the whole episode, and when the coast was clear and they could go on their way, the two were still chuckling. Such a sense of humor the black people have, so far.
Well, you managed, Donald Woods, to keep your sense of humor in that piece. Was it harder to keep your sense of humor as time went on?
Yes, in South Africa, you have to keep a sense of humor or you go crazy. You know, some horrible things happen there and you erect a kind of protective shell around you, and part of that is humor.
The banning order really backfired, don't you think? And from the South African perspective, the idea was to shut you up, and instead you became an internationally renowned
I like to think it backfired badly for them. It is really very stupid of them because I had a very limited constituency there. I was reaching at the most 160,000 people a day through my newspaper, and once a week through my syndicated column, a couple of millions. But, you know, that wasn't going to bring the government down. And when they banned me, they certainly sort of gave me a wider platform.
You are from a family, I believe, of fifth-generation South Africans. Did your parents support apartheid?
Yes. Oh, we all did. I did until about the age of 20 or so. Virtually all whites in South Africa thought apartheid was a good thing, and most of them still do.
How is the goodness of it explained to
well,
you when
good
you're
meaning,
growing up?
Preferable to whites, beneficial to whites. If you live in a society which gives you everything of the best, you grow up thinking that's the way things should be.
Now, you grew up right on the outskirts, I guess, with the Bamvana tribe?
That's right. This is the most remote, you could probably describe it as primitive in urban terms, territory in South Africa, or Bamvana land. It's a place most South Africans don't know about. It's the equivalent would be a reservation, yeah, in the old days. And my dad was a trader, so I grew up among, you know, what most people would describe as very primitive tribesmen, not at all typical of most black South Africans.
So you learned that tribe's language?
Yes, yes.
And you were one of the few white children in that area?
Yes, I think there was one white family among hundreds of thousands of blacks.
Did you make friends with
the black children from that
area?
Well, they were the only ones, the only other kids around, you see. And but it was funny how you played games with them and you're friendly with them, but it stopped rigidly at the door. They didn't come into the house or anything. And then I'd go away to a white boarding school, which was so different from where I came from. So you had the highly segregated society, and yet on that level, when I was home, I could have, as playmates, the blacks.
It's interesting because probably as a child you had more interaction with black children than, say, a lot of white Americans do.
Oh, probably. And yet, it didn't have a liberalizing effect, quite the contrary, because the kids I was playing with couldn't write their names, they didn't speak English, they wore loincloths. So whereas one would think this would liberalize me, it sort of had the opposite effect at that stage.
You said that you didn't oppose apartheid till you were around 20.
Yes, I was a student at Cape Town University.
Well, in your autobiography, you quote the kind of argument you'd make in support of apartheid. And you'd say things like, when asked about what the best policy for blacks might be, you'd say things like, it's send them back to the reserves and shoot them. It's them or us.
I think it was send them back or shoot them. That is what we were brought up, that they must either belong in the remote areas of the country or we might have to shoot them one day because they'll want to take over. And this is what most white South Africans are reared to believe and fear.
What was it in your upbringing that led to the kind of severity, the real deep belief that you had that it was them or us?
I think the overriding fear, the old saying, you know, he who mounts the tiger fears to dismount. When you've got 5 million whites suppressing 30 million blacks, they're scared to stop suppressing them because they're scared of the revenge that the blacks might visit on them. Although, remarkably, the blacks throughout Africa have an incredible record of not exacting revenge on white minorities that lose control. The most recent examples in Zimbabwe, where I've just spent 3 months, and I just can't get over how forgiving the black majority has been to Ian Smith's Rhodesians.
What changed you when you were in your early 20s? What made you think that apartheid wasn't such a good idea after all?
The first thing was studying law. And, you know, when you study South African law, which is based on Roman law, you study the principles of perfect justice. And it didn't seem to go with that. Apartheid didn't seem to go with the principles of perfect justice. I also had a remarkable lecturer called Harold Levy, who I admired very much. And he sort of quite subtly put dents in my prejudices. And I began to turn away from it then. I didn't turn into a radical demonstrating student, but I began for the first time to think, this isn't as good as I thought it was.
You started writing for the opposition paper, the Daily Dispatch. What kind of bounds were created? What could you say and get away with, and what was going too far in the newspaper?
Theoretically, you couldn't say anything nasty about the government because they had 22 laws which limited what could be written. But in practice, you could say almost anything at that stage because although they had these laws in reserve, they did not like proceeding against journalists because this would look bad overseas. And in fact, for a number of years, they kept to that. They tended not to want to hammer journalists, but then they started doing so in the early 70s. And eventually, they got around to me in 1977.
When you started writing for the newspaper, the Daily Dispatch, were there whites and blacks at the paper?
No, just white reporters. But when I became editor in 1965, or shortly before that, we started getting a couple of black reporters. And then when I, after I was editor, we got a lot of black journalists in. And certainly by the time I left, it was an integrated staff.
Exiled South African journalist Donald Woods is my guest. You met Stephen Biko in, I think it was 1973.
Yeah.
How did you first meet him, and what was he doing at the time?
He was leader of the Black Consciousness Movement, but he was under a restriction. He had to stay in his house and not talk to more than one person at a time. And ironically, the same restriction I later got. And in fact, I used to attack him and his movement in my newspaper because I considered them too radical. See, this was the irony, that I was accused of being sort of communistic. And actually, if I were to assess myself, I'd say I'm fairly conservative. And I'm a capitalist. And I'm middle class, middle aged, and just about everything. You don't get a sort of wild communist agitator. Well, I thought they were too radical. And I also thought that their response to apartheid was xenophobic because it was blacks, you know, down it, to hell with the whites, the blacks must do this. And even the liberal whites are in the way. So I thought this was racist, and I called it apartheid in reverse. And one of his associates came into my office and said if I had any sense of fairness, I would go and see him because what I was writing was inaccurate. So I went to see him, and I found that what I had been writing was inaccurate, that black consciousness wasn't racism. It was an affirmation that blacks had to acquire the psychological liberation from apartheid and to assume the leadership of their own liberation, which is entirely legitimate. So from then on, we became friends.
Were there examples that he gave you that made you come around to that point of view?
No, I think it was just being with him and discussing all these issues. He had such an impressive intellect. And he himself, you had to be with him only about 20 minutes to know there was not a scrap of racism in him. And he had white friends, you know.
What kind of things did you write in your column in support of the work that he was doing?
Basically trying to explain to other whites in South Africa why this was not a threat, and on the contrary, that we had to dismantle apartheid entirely and actually follow black leadership into a black-dominated republic. Democratic, but obviously black-dominated because in South Africa, 5 out of every 6 people are black. And if you have a democracy, you're going to end up with a, you know, black-led government, which is fine.
Because you were writing about him and endorsing the Black Consciousness Movement, it was known by everybody that you and Biko were friends. Were you harassed by police authorities?
Oh, yes. We had bullets fired into the house. We had my youngest child was attacked by the security police. They sent a little T-shirt with acid powder in it. And we had almost daily threats, bomb threats, you know.
Stephen Biko was arrested for, I guess it was the fourth time in 1977, and he died after being tortured and beaten. I think the death resulted directly from brain injuries.
That's
from,
right.
From the beating that he received. The authorities told you what?
Well, they told the country that they implied that he died of hunger strike.
Did you believe that?
Not for a minute, no, because his wife and I went and we had quite a long search before we were able to see the body. We found it in a little morgue in King Williamstown. And when we saw his body, we knew, obviously, but we'd known anyway, that he wouldn't have gone on hunger strike. And then I managed to get hold of, by means I can't ever be too explicit about, medical evidence, a pathologist report after his body, after post-mortem, and this proved that he'd been assaulted and had died of blows to the head. So I published this and was arrested shortly after.
Did he ever tell you that he'd never do anything like go on a hunger strike?
Yes, we once had a discussion, and neither of us thought it would ever come to pass, but you know, so many dissidents had died in jails. And I said, he said, if they ever claim I hanged myself or strangled myself or starved myself, you are to know it's a lie. In effect, raise hell, you know.
So he expected that something like this might be pulled at some point.
I don't think he did, but he just said academically, if it ever should happen. And in fact, I don't think the South African government ever wanted him killed. What happened with Biko was they feared him very much, and they wanted him locked up. But the Port Elizabeth security police were particularly notorious in their brutality, and they beat him up, and they went too far. And I know the government got a terrible fright, the members of the cabinet, because they knew this was big trouble. And indeed it was. They've never really recovered. You know, the name Biko haunts them up until this day, and I think it'll go on doing so.
For those reasons, did you think that he would be comparatively safe in prison, that they wouldn't kill him because of the backlash that
he and I both thought that was the probability, but that there's always the possibility of the other.
How did you find out about his death?
My secretary told me. I got into the office one morning, and she said there'd been a phone call from his family. And I just disbelieved it. I said, no, even this government's not that stupid. Must be a mistake. Then I found it was true.
What did you do?
I don't know. It was such a mixture of grief and anger, you know. I immediately went to a number of cities and made speeches of accusation and published a lot of angry editorials and joined his other friends who were demonstrating or, you know, condemning what had happened.
Did you think that there would be a greater crackdown on you because of your outspokenness about his death?
At that time, I wasn't thinking of such a thing. It didn't matter. You know, when you're really angry, you don't think much of that. And in particular, I wanted to put the heat on their embassies in America and Britain and Europe. So what I did was send a lot of stuff to the press. I sent pictures of his body out, and I sent articles out about him and about his death. And these were used all over the world to the South African government. In fact, that's why they got pressured into having a kind of inquest.
How soon did the banning order come after Biko's death?
Well, he died on September the 12th, 1977, and I was banned on October the 19th.
What were you doing when they presented the banning order to you?
I was about to get on a plane in Johannesburg, and three of them stepped up.
Three
security officers. And they asked me to come with them, and handed me this long list of documents signed by the Minister of Police. And that's all the different restrictions. Like, you, from now on, for 5 years, you've got to stay at home. You can't talk to more than one person at a time. You can't be in a room with more than one person at a time. You can't write anything, not even a diary or postcard. You can't be quoted in the press. It's a whole range of restrictions like that.
You started writing a book about Stephen Biko shortly after you were banned.
Yes.
How did you hide the manuscript?
I hid it in a record album, an Ed Murrow recording of the speeches of Winston Churchill. I thought that was appropriate. And it was in among hundreds of other records, so they would have had a job finding that one.
What's the punishment if you're caught violating the banning order?
You can get quite a long term of imprisonment and increased harassment.
And no doubt they'd really like to catch you.
That's what they told me. They said, there's nothing we'd like more than if you break this ban so we can put you inside.
My guest is exiled South African journalist Donald Woods. We'll continue the interview after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Exiled South African journalist Donald Woods is my guest. Why did you want to escape and leave South Africa? It was a 5-year banning order.
The main motive was to, I'd promised Steve Biko that if he got killed like this, I'd raise as much hell as possible. Also, it was my natural inclination to do that then, because I had such a feeling of, people very kindly call it courage, but it isn't, it's indignation. You get so indignant that you feel you've got to do something, and the more you can do, the better. And I knew that by sitting quietly in my house, I couldn't cause them any problems. Whereas if I could get to New York or London, there's no end of prospects of hassling the embassies there. And that's what I've been doing for the last 8 years.
How did you plan out your escape? You probably figured
badly.
You were being monitored,
badly,
right?
Yes. The plan we cooked up was actually terribly amateurish. And it's really almost a miracle that it worked, because so many things went wrong and nearly went wrong and could have gone wrong. But eventually I got across into Lesotho. I was disguised as a priest and my hair was dyed black. I looked quite different to what I normally looked like.
What did you do to make yourself look like a priest?
Well, my wife dyed my hair black, and through methods which even to this day I wouldn't like to implicate anyone by disclosing, I borrowed a priest's outfit. And also I had a fallback. Let's just say that I initially planned to wade across the Tela River, which is a very small river, but...
This is the river that
separates
South Africa
from Lesotho. But you must realize Lesotho is surrounded by South Africa. It's like an enclave inside. But at least if you get in there, they look after you. It's a very brave little black-ruled country. So, but the river was... They had 4 days of rain continuously. And so the river was a raging flood. There were bits of tree trunk being whipped past. And I had the manuscript of my Steve Biko book with me. So I certainly couldn't swim across that lot with this thing. And so I had a fallback plan, and that was a fake passport. So eventually I had to bluff my way through the border guards with this fake passport. And that worked.
What did you tell them?
Well, I just said I was saying I had an early mass to say across in quitting. See, fortunately, and this is the reason we chose this little remote border post, there was a Catholic mission called St. Teresa's, just a few miles away. And apparently priests quite often would go through to say mass in Kuting, and Lesotho is a very Catholic country. So that was that covered me very well, and that's how I got off.
How were you smuggled out of your house?
I lay on the floor of the car, and my wife put a coat over me, and she backed out right past the security police chap. You know, when they've been watching you for months, they don't sort of look down into the floor of the car. And that's how she got me beyond the city limits. Then I hitchhiked to a point where a friend was arranged to meet me and drive me to the border. She went back and showed a movie for the kids, and over the tapped telephone she gave the impression that I was upstairs asleep. And then the next morning they all left by another route. Now they could get out on ordinary tourist visas, you see. So they got out by another route, and then we all met up in Lesotho. Then we flew out in a tiny plane across South African territory for 2.5 hours into Botswana. And before we took off, we had threats from the South African government that they'd force the plane down if we tried to fly across. But that they were just bluffing. They were trying to intimidate us.
Your goal once gaining freedom was to continue to publicize what had happened to Stephen Biko and to continue to fight against apartheid. What were the most effective means you had for doing that, living in exile?
Oh, terrific opportunities. You can really cost the South African government literally millions by, you see, every time a program like this happens, that we're talking on now, the South African embassies and consulates go into a little minor frenzy and they say, how do we counter this? And so that ties them up a bit more. Sometimes in the early stages, they were suckered into confrontations on television, then they soon stopped that. Then you help put pressure on there. On their position at the UN and in their embassies by publishing through broadcasts or newspaper articles exactly what they're doing there. And they find it very hard to answer because these are facts.
The press restrictions are much greater now than they were when you were there. It was pretty comparatively open when you were writing.
Yes, they've imposed full censorship now. And you see, their reason is they are the one thing that terrifies them, and the one thing that I keep traveling around advocating is divestment and international sanctions. Now, they're terrified of that because they cannot indefinitely sustain apartheid without overseas bank loans and investments. It makes it far harder and more costly for them, and it limits their capacity to continue oppressing the majority. So in order to stop these images on television of white police clubbing or whipping blacks, they've imposed the censorship, and they've imposed on the newspaper press as well.
Do you ever think about what you would be able to do in your fight against apartheid if you were still working for a newspaper in South Africa?
Well, I'd be able to do nothing. You know, if I'd either be banned and silenced in that way, or I'd be working for a newspaper that's not allowed to print political news. I mean, the way they are heading, they will only be content if the newspapers there are limited to sports results and cooking recipes.
Do you think you would have stayed under those circumstances?
No.
Because there's no point if you can't fight?
There are two reasons that my wife and I have often talked about it. Even if what happened hadn't happened, we would have done what we've done for another reason. And that is that when my eldest son, who was then 11 or 12, when he reached military age, which is 17, I had three sons, two daughters. Now, when the stage was reached that those three boys had to go into the army, that's when we would have left, because there was no way our kids were going to go into uniform to fight black South Africans inside their own country or anywhere.
Was it a challenge to bring up children in an apartheid state who didn't believe in apartheid?
Yes, because they got a lot of hassle at school. They'd be told they're the one whose dad is an agitator and all that sort of thing. And also, the only thing we didn't like about that was at the schools, they'd be, through peer pressure, hearing racial ideas all the time. So in a sense, that's been a blessing for the kids to be brought up without that kind of environment.
Richard Attenborough is doing a movie about your family and Stephen Biko's family.
Yes, and apartheid generally.
What could you tell us about the movie?
Just that all the shooting's completed and they're busy editing it. And it's hard for me to judge subjectively because my wife and I have been consultants on it, and we're so close to the project. But as objectively as possible, I think he's done a wonderful, wonderful job, because he's stuck to the truth. He's stuck to real events that occurred. And, I just think that it's a very good film.
Who plays you and who plays Biko?
Steve Biko is played by a black American named Denzel Washington. And I'm played by a white American called Kevin Kline. And both of them had to spend a long time learning the right accents. In fact, I saw Kevin a couple of nights ago in New York, and it was funny to see him with black hair again and without my kind of glasses on, because he was made up to look like I had looked 9 years ago. And to see him talking American again.
Was it a kick to see somebody playing you on the screen?
It's very flattering. It did my ego a lot of good.
Donald Woods, I want to thank you very much
for
being
you.
With us. My guest has been exiled South African journalist Donald Woods, who now lives in London. The movie based on his friendship with Stephen Biko will be released this November. It's titled Cry Freedom. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with artist Keith Haring, whose work is inspired by subway graffiti. His colorful designs can be seen in museums, amusement parks, rock clubs, subways, and on T-shirts, so I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I speak with stand-up comic Jerry Seinfeld. After frequent spots on Carson and Letterman, he has his own HBO special. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the newest recording by 95-year-old pianist Mstislav Horzovsky, whose musical heritage goes back to Chopin and Beethoven. And guest commentator David Mark defends television from the charge that it's responsible for the decline in reading. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a recording by the pianist Mstislav Horzovsky. Horzovsky was born 95 years ago in Poland and now lives in Philadelphia, where he teaches at the Curtis Institute of Music. The album reveals a man who continues to approach his music with passion and sensitivity.
Pianist Mstislav Horzovsky's name has been a name I've valued for years, but only in conjunction with other names I value. In other words, I think of him primarily as a chamber music specialist, a partner to some of the greatest musicians of this century, Pablo Casals, violinist Joseph Szigety, clarinetist Reginald Kell, the Budapest Quartet. He also made several marvelous chamber music recordings as a member of the short-lived New York Quartet. In fact, because I never heard him play a recital, I never really thought of Horzovsky as a soloist, even though he recorded the Chopin First Piano Concerto over 30 years ago and has performed complete cycles of Beethoven and Mozart sonatas in concert. None Such Records, however, has remedied this misconception with its recent release of a Horzovsky solo album, recorded last year when he was 94 years old. This is no mere souvenir of a once distinguished artist or a feat of inventive engineering. These are very much performances that show the wisdom and rediscovered innocence of old age. Even the Debussy Children's Corner Suite has an air of profound retrospection, the great-grandfather watching the young ones with nostalgia and infinite sympathy. Though Horzovsky has no direct descendants of his own, the liner notes tell us he married for the first time in 1981 when he was 89. His touch is tenderly secure and eloquent. His tempos are on the slow side, but rhythmically alive. The pace never flags. What we get isn't so much a performance as a vision. Here's part of the most extraordinary selection on the record, Mozart's achingly beautiful Fantasy in D minor, one of those archetypal Mozart works that gets deeper and sadder the more beautiful it gets, a piece that in its very brevity seems both to question and accept the mystery of time itself and the pain of its inevitable passing.
Thank you.
Horzovsky is a direct musical descendant of Beethoven and Chopin. His great teacher, Theodor Leschetizky, was a student of Beethoven's pupil, Czerny. Horzovsky's mother studied with a student of Chopin's. This new record includes two Chopin nocturnes and Beethoven's Second Sonata. It's a generous selection that demonstrates the generosity of its performer. This entire record makes me think of what Yeats, towards the end of his life, called tragic joy, and especially these lines from his extraordinary poem, The Apparitions, which he wrote when he was a mere 73. When a man grows old, his joy grows more deep day after day. His empty heart is full at length, but he has need of all that strength because of the increasing night that opens her mystery and fright.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches English and creative writing at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He reviewed a new Nonesuch recording by pianist Mstislav Horzovsky. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jerry Seinfeld, a young stand-up comic whose humor appeals to fans of both Johnny Carson and David Letterman. After frequent appearances on each of their shows, he's starring in his own comedy special this Saturday night on HBO. Seinfeld's humor is observational. Some of it draws on his childhood, growing up in a middle-class family in suburban Long Island, and experiences like being dragged along by his mother on a shopping trip to buy wallpaper.
And you know when you get bored, your feet just kind of start to drag and you just... Mom, can we get out of here already, please? Mom, come on, let's go. They don't have him. The guy talked to the other guy. They don't. No, I don't think they're in the back. I don't even think they have a back here. Let's just get out of here, all right? Of course, when you're a little kid and you get bored, you can't support your body weight at all. You have to really just lie down wherever you are. Your parents, they take you to the bank. That was the classic one. My parents take me to the bank, they turn around from the teller, and I was just flat out on the floor, just can't make it, Mom. And they get so upset, would you get up off the floor, please? Get up! I can't get up, Mom, it's too dull in here.
This is a time when a lot of comics with crazy personas are making it big, people like Emo and Bob Goldthwait. And you come on like a nice middle-class guy in a suit. Do you consider that your comic persona? Or is that you?
It's me. Well, that's the only way I could do it every night. I don't know how these people have the energy to concoct a personality and maintain it week in and week out. I would find that exhausting.
Do you think it's a trap in a way that persona can become a kind of prison you can't get out of?
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, what happens when you decide you want to talk about something else? I mean, if it falls in the category of something I'm interested in, I can talk about it. You know, it doesn't have to fit anything. It just has to be me.
When you were getting started, did you ever try on more zany personalities in order to get laughs?
When you're starting, you don't know what the hell you're doing. I mean, when I was starting, it was 1976, and the elections were on. And I remember I had a line about Scoop Jackson that I thought he sounded like the Baskin-Robbins counterman of the week. And I remember that was one of my big jokes. And I had a joke about, what else did I have? I had a joke about the tramway here in New York being the first ride, that the city was going bankrupt and that they're putting up rides for us and that eventually we'll be seeing like roller coasters in the South Bronx, which would be the first roller coasters where people scream on the flat part of the ride.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah, but no, I never had any real... personas, no. I always, you know, idolized people like Bill Cosby and people that were just themselves. I mean, I think the idea of a comedian is someone that you relate to. I think comedy star is almost an oxymoron. You don't look up to comedians like you look at Madonna or, you know, Elvis or people like that. They're, you know, those are people from other planets. Comedians are people that you go, people come up to me and talk to me, they just use my first name, or they don't even introduce themselves, they just start talking. And that's how you know you're it's working, you know. That's what you want them to feel about you, that you're just someone they know.
Was it difficult at the beginning, trying to figure out how to make what was probably a pretty sheltered and comfortable middle-class background really funny to people?
I never think of terms of how what's my background or anything. I would just talk about anything that struck me funny.
You have a great bit about how bored you were when your mother used to drag you to wallpaper stores to go shopping. What brought back memories like that?
I saw a kid in a store, and I saw that great kid response where you don't think I shouldn't lie down in public. You think, I'm bored, I'm lying down. And the kids just do whatever they want, and they're hilarious to me. But I don't really get it, actually, from seeing kids as much as I actually remember it myself. I remember lying down in the store. I remember begging my mother for a dime so I could sit on a metal horse that vibrates.
I remember all of that stuff, too. I remember how really boring it was to be taken from store to store and to the bank. You're very funny about the bank, about why do people go to banks?
Yeah, and you're so low down, you know, you can't see anything. You know, you just see, like, the price tags hanging off the sleeves of the shirts, and everyone else is enjoying shopping, and you're just looking at all these stanchions and aluminum things that hold everything up, and
I'm so short, my life is still like that.
The bank, especially those teller things, I always looked at, what is going on up there, you know? But I remember it. I don't know. I have, like, youth recall, I guess.
When you started doing your material, were you ever worried that your parents would come and hear your act and they'd be a little insulted? We didn't know he was bored when we took him
yes.
to the bank.
Yes, I was petrified when they first saw me. Well, also because I wasn't really funny as a kid, and I felt like I was, you know, exposing this alter ego, you know. Plus, here I am getting up on stage and manipulating these people, you know, into laughing. It's a power thing, you know, and it's weird to do it in front of your parents. Because in front of your parents, you always want them to have the power. And then all of a sudden, you get up in this, you know, very controlling situation. I mean, a comedian is basically a very aggressive thing to do. You force people to see things your way so powerfully they react audibly. You force them to react, to look at things the way I look at them and laugh at it when I say to.
When you put it in power terms, it becomes a very potentially arrogant thing to say, I'm good enough, I'm going to stand up here and make everybody laugh.
Absolutely.
They can all see it my way.
Yeah.
What made you think that you could do it and that being a stand-up comic wasn't a totally absurd and ridiculous idea?
I didn't think I could do it. I thought this is a totally absurd and ridiculous idea. But that's exactly what I thought. And I said, but I have to try it. I have to try it. Because I thought this is the pinnacle of life to me. If you could do this, you know, if you could stand up on stage and make people laugh, that would be the ultimate accomplishment of my personality. And I just thought laughs, to be working with laughs and jokes all the time, what a fun life that would be.
Did you pay your dues playing bars and clubs where you were totally ignored?
I'm still paying them, Terry.
Are you really?
I worked a club last year where the waitress, to get to her tables, had to step up on the stage and walk between me and the audience. And people think I'm embellishing this story. She had to stand up on stage. She'd walk between me and the audience. She'd get the drink order, back up on stage, back in front of me and the audience. This was in Ohio. Where in Ohio? I can't even remember.
Are audiences more willing to go along with you after they've seen you on TV?
You get a free 90 seconds when people have seen you on TV and they know who you are. You get up on stage, for the first 90 seconds, I would say, to 3 minutes, they will laugh at just about anything you say, and then it's right back to where you've always been when you were a complete unknown.
So it doesn't help too much.
No, people don't laugh because they recognize you. You know, they do at first, but they don't. It wears off pretty quick. You know, you've got to be funny every night.
How do you work on your routine? You have some ideas, but you've really got to put it together into a good a good routine, a good bit.
I get an idea, and I think there's something funny about that, and I don't know what it is at first. This is how my stuff usually works. Like, I saw, you know, like McDonald's having a sign that says 60 billion. And I think, now that's, you know, there's something very funny about that. That a company of that size is still counting every burger. You know, I mean, there's some kind of insecurity there that you're still thinking, how well, are we doing well? We're doing well. Aren't we doing well? Look at how many we've sold, you know. And I don't know, you know, who really cares besides them? And besides which, what is their ultimate goal? You know, if 60 billion is not enough, I mean, do they want cows surrendering, just voluntarily showing up and going, we give up. You've sold so many burgers, we're turning ourselves in. So I don't know. So I look at things, I go, what's funny about that? But like in my show, I talk about Tide being improved. That's a classic kind of joke that I like to do. Now, why would a comedian look at Tide detergent being improved and think that's funny? To me, you know, comedians generally talk about dating or something, but why are they improving Tide? You know, it's just things I have to think about. Does anyone care? So
why are they improving Tide?
They want it. It's getting out bloodstains now. And I think if you got a T-shirt with bloodstains on it, maybe laundry isn't your biggest problem. Maybe you ought to get rid of the body first before you do the wash.
You end your HBO special by saying, you've been a great audience. Now, do you really mean it when you tell an audience that?
Yeah. I don't say it all the time. You should come to a week of my shows. They're not always great. And if they're not, I don't say anything. I just say thank you and I hope you enjoyed it. That's the best I could say.
Jerry Seinfeld, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Comedian Jerry Seinfeld is starring in his first comedy special this Saturday night on HBO. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. John Hockenberry is joining us from Washington. Hi, John.
Hi, Terry.
What stories are coming up on the program?
Well, the Department of Transportation is forcing the airlines to reveal and disclose to American consumers their record of delayed departures. And that's something that people are going to be very interested in. Also, the founder of the Air and Space Museum, the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum, whose life spans the history of modern aviation, we're going to have a profile of him. And there is an enormous gob of money hovering over the United States waiting to land.
Could you translate that, John?
Well, the Super Collider Project, it's an enormously expensive government science project, and the states very much want to have it in their state. An enormous competition tonight.
Thanks, John. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Guest commentator David Mark joins us again with some thoughts about television and reading. It's often said that TV is responsible for people not reading more, but Mark thinks television is a symptom of the problem rather than its cause.
The anti-illiteracy commercials on television tell us that reading is fun. Most people who read would agree. The satisfaction of transforming the silent ink symbols on a piece of paper into images and stories, into songs and scents, and finally into new experience is a sweet achievement. One of the perks of being human. But, as you might gather from the frequency with which those anti-illiteracy commercials are appearing, the book is losing its competitive edge these days. Reading makes a non-negotiable demand for long periods of undivided attention. It is possible to read sloppily, to fall in and out of sync with the text, to move along turning pages regardless of one's degree of comprehension. But, if the activity is to be called reading at all, it requires an intense act of absolute concentration. The eyes penetrating the paragraphs and moving across the lines. The pausing at commas. The halting at periods. The silent exhortation of an exclamation point. Television is more user-friendly than reading, and it is often blamed for the literacy crisis. There is surely some truth in this, but TV is just one of many contemporary activities that competes with the book for aesthetic shelf space. Take electronically reproduced music, for example. Stereo is available everywhere, not just in the living room, but on the street, in the shower, on an airplane. And what about driving? Life behind the wheel can be a seamless web of cubist experience. Despite the numbness of repetition, there is an excitement in reading the world through the windshield. The car allows you to simultaneously penetrate the world and keep it at bay. Unlike reading a book, driving lends itself to a multimedia environment. A half dozen radio formats, including this one, are available at your fingertip. Or perhaps you would prefer to seize control of the media and pop in a tape. Mozart, Madonna, or maybe E.G. Marshall reading Moby Dick. Conversations that include little or no eye contact can be carried on in a car for hours by people sitting just inches apart. A driver's attention is continually divided and fractured. Architecture, topography, weather, and proximity to the insane can all make dents in drive time consciousness. Watching television is an activity midway between the social isolation of reading and the social hyperboles of driving. TV demands attention, but only a share of it. You do have the option of just sitting and watching, but you can also cook dinner, balance your checkbook, or even chat on the telephone and still absorb enough of a TV show to honestly say that you've watched it. As a consequence, TV viewing offers itself as the default activity of domestic life. Is it so strange that people turn on their sets like lamps when entering their homes? Television offers an endless procession of emotional, erotic, and instructional images. Quality may be erratic, but quantity is astounding. Why shouldn't the set be playing? Maybe something good is on. We move with speed and we are used to instant gratification. A preference for the slow, sometimes difficult charms of reading is increasingly unusual. The reader has become a nonconformist, not simply because more people watch television than read, but rather because anyone with the time and solitude for reading these days is living anything but an ordinary life.
David Mark teaches at Brandeis University and is the author of Demographic Vistas, Television in American Culture. Here's a look ahead to the next Fresh Air. Next time, the host of the TV game show Jeopardy! Who is Alex Trebek? Rock critic Ken Tucker will review Bad, the long-awaited album by Michael Jackson, and film critic Stephen Schiff will review the new Vietnam War movie, Hamburger Hill, so I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Additional help from Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.